and welcome to Just Thinking. My name is Kevin Doherty. I'm your host for the podcast today. I am the Chief Strategy Officer for 806 Technologies. And today I'm delighted to have a great friend, a new friend, and a guest, Dr. Quinn Woods, a.k.a. Dr. Q. Hey, Dr. Q. So tell the folks on the podcast today.
Well, it's a first of all, Kevin, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And thank you so much for the invite being on here. With I'd love to be here. And so who am I? Well, I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm an educator of 27 years. And I've probably, like many of the audience out there, I was a coach and a teacher and got into administration and just kind of have done several roles in education. It's been a great career.
So talk to me a little bit, talk to everybody a little bit about what was the most rewarding aspect of being an educator, whether at the classroom level or the administrative level, service center, what did you find most rewarding?
What I found most rewarding as an administrator was the old adage that if there was a problem, you had the opportunity to fix it. And I remember as a teacher being frustrated because there were some problems and I could only control what was happening in my classroom for the most part. And so some of those bigger issues, I didn't really have any influence or authority to mess with. And so as an administrator, particularly the principal in that seat, you have the power, you have the authority to make changes and hopefully for the better. And so that's what I found the most rewarding was as problems occurred and popped up, we were able to come up with some really cool and unique solutions.
Nice. So something tells me that has a bit to do with this transition that you went through from being an educator to being in this Dr. Q consulting gig. So tell us a little bit about your new gig. What was it that caused you to make the shift? And what are some of the things you're learning as you're in this new role, the pluses, the minuses, all of it? So tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Q Consulting, really what in a nutshell, what that's about is I help educators win the classroom. And so that might be teachers, that might be administrators who are struggling. I know there's a lot of new teachers out there. There's a lot of struggling teachers out there. And so they just need guidance and they need help and support. And I, as a teacher, honestly, as a struggling teacher, you know, I kind of learned the hard way how to become a better teacher. And I take those experiences and I help a lot of teachers. Similarly, as a successful administrator, I help new and struggling administrators just more efficiently run their campuses, whether that's systems or processes or, you know, expectations or, you know, just a number of things that we look at. What got me from the ESC to Dr. Q Consulting was really a lot about just flexibility with the family. My daughter had some health issues at the time and I just needed more flexibility to be home a little bit more frequently. And to not have to ask my boss, hey, I need off again. And so, you know, just after a number of those instances and just wanting to be home and care for my daughter, it just kind of led me to, hey, let's do this on my own. I think I know enough people now to, you know, go out and start your own business. So that's what got it.
So what's been the greatest reward so far besides the flexibility?
Well, just the amazing opportunity to work with just wonderful people out there, whether that's in Dallas or Houston or around East Texas. I mean, there's so many great educators to work with. And so it's just really a pleasure to be able to give back my knowledge and expertise, whether that's teachers, administrators. And most recently, I've been able to work with students again. And it's funny because they're struggling students, and that seems to be my target market, right? Struggling teachers, struggling students, struggling administrators, but they need help. And again, they need help and support, and so I'm able to give back and pour myself into those students, and just kind of we talk about life and just kind of how life has hit them, and you know what are we going to do about it? How are we going to solve problems and what's after high school and just really kind of having some really powerful conversations that I'm not sure anybody else is having with these particular students.
You know, it sounds like one of the great advantages for a school or a district bringing in someone from the outside, because you're not bound by a lot of the restrictions of being in the organization itself. You bring a forest through the trees perspective and a fresh approach to things that I'm sure is really refreshing for students, teachers, administrators alike. I also, you know, you just mentioned the idea that the common thread here is struggling. So struggling students, struggling teachers, struggling administrators. Did you experience struggles yourself as a teacher, as a student, as an administrator? And if so, how do you draw from that in your work today?
Yeah, so not so much as a student. I mean, I was an okay student. I probably could have done better if I had applied myself, but I just kind of did enough. I made A's and B's. I didn't really have to work hard to do that in high school particularly. As a teacher, yes, absolutely, I struggled. My first year was pretty much a disaster. My second year was a little better. Spring break, I was told to watch Harry Wong videos, the whole collection. And so before spring break, the HR director comes down to my room and says, hey, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to watch these videos over spring break. And I'm kind of like, okay, I not that I have anything else planned, so I will watch the videos. And I can tell you, game changer, it changed the course of my career. I watched the videos. I took the task very sincerely. I took notes. I created procedures and routines and rules and expectations and all the things that the videos were trying to teach me. And I hit the ground running Monday after spring break. And so I always tell teachers, it's never too late to turn your classroom around. Why? Because I did it the Monday after spring break. I had a great school year from that Monday to the end. We got more, I taught more, we got more accomplished in those few weeks than I did the rest, you know, prior to that. And so that really put my career on a new path. And then my first year as an administrator, similar story. I struggled a bit. I was a secondary teacher, and my first principal role was an elementary school. And so there's just enough differences there where I really didn't know. Obviously, as a first year administrator, you think you know what you know, but you don't know really anything. So you're kind of learning that. And then, you know, you learn what to say, what not to say. And there were some struggles there. And so I had some interventions with my superintendent and in the assistant soup. But kind of a similar success story there at the end of the year. Had an incredible teacher appreciation week, and just kind of ended the year on a positive note. And we went from rumors of teachers, you know, a bunch of teachers leaving. We only had one resignation, and she ended up retiring. So it was to be able to retain 99% of the staff that next year, that was powerful.
Yeah, that's huge. Well, what I like about what you just shared too is, thinking back to my years as a teacher and a principal, that time from spring break to the end of the school year is a blur, right? And you very easily could have, I know you were getting some intervention there, but you could have just tried to glide, just kind of close your eyes and go through the rest of the year and hope that, you know, things didn't all totally fall apart by the time you open them up in the end of May. So I love that idea that it's not too late. It wasn't September, it wasn't October, it wasn't January. You're talking March, and which is a time when a lot of folks are starting to check out and not be as engaged and focused and so forth. So the fact that you were able to do it then is even more remarkable, given my experience. I also wanted to say, rest his soul, Harry Wong passed away a couple months ago. It's nice to see that his wife is keeping things going through the website and all that. But how has that shaped? Because it sounds like a lot of the work you're doing in schools and districts is the very work you did then as a teacher and a principal. So talk to that a little bit, if you would, Dr. Q.
Yeah, so a lot of what I do is heavy with the Harry Wong and the videos that I learned all those years ago. And when you combine that with Get Better Faster, because that book is really powerful in the work that I do now. Teach Like a Champion, that's another book that heavily influences what I do. But if you kind of, you know, not summarize all of that, but if you kind of compile all of that into one movement, you can really help teachers with classroom management, instructional delivery. But the key is the laser focus and keeping it small, because we want to get what's called small wins. You got to get the teacher to feel successful. And how do you do that? You do it by breaking things down and creating small wins. And so you mentioned, you know, forest of the trees, trees of the forest, and I'm not sure which way it goes, but you want to definitely keep an eye on that big picture, but sometimes you got to zoom in on that one tree. And so teachers will say, well, what do I do first? Well, how do kids enter your room? Because that's how it starts. That sets the tone for the rest of the class period. So what I tell teachers is, if your classroom is an extension of the chaos that's happening in the hallway, then we're not setting our students up for success. We need to create a procedure, how to enter the room procedure, that has them come in an orderly way and where they're starting to work immediately, because we want students to understand that when you enter this room, work begins immediately. This is a space of work and, you know, and structure. And so we want to, you know, we kind of want to get teachers on that piece right away.
So let's talk a little bit now on this whole idea of the standard versus expectation. So this is something you and I have talked about offline a little bit, but speak to our viewers, our listeners, about this whole distinction between standard versus expectation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is when you're talking about struggling teachers or struggling administrators, it becomes apparent that there either is no standard, or we communicate the standard, but then it's just, you know, that it's just empty words and there's no follow through with that. And so something I learned as a struggling teacher implementing the procedures and routines was, when I taught a procedure, I taught it, I modeled it, and then we role played it, and then we practiced it. And let me give a shout out to coaches, athletic coaches, and band teachers, and drama teachers, because you do this really well. You know the power of practice. And so you teach a procedure and then you practice that procedure over and over and over again until you get what I call 100% participation and perfection. And then you can stop practicing the procedure. And when you do that, you're declaring to your students, hey, there's a standard in this room that when you do procedure X, whatever that procedure is, we are going to do it the right way every single time. And when you don't, I'm willing to lose instructional time to practice the procedure because I value the standard over wasting time through inefficient procedures. And so, and that's kind of an argument there. Sometimes teachers will say, well, I don't have time to do that. Yeah, you do have time, because you're losing all that time in inefficient procedures. And can I give you a real example of this? Okay, so I was working with a kindergarten teacher, And she had this procedure where they're on the carpet with marker boards and markers and a sock as the eraser. That was my favorite part, was the sock as the eraser. And so she would tell them, okay, it's time to put your supplies away. And so they would get up and they would walk across the room, and there were some drawers. And so they would open the drawers and put their stuff in there and close the drawer. And then they would come back to the carpet. Well, I'm secretly timing this in the back of the room, and I'm watching this take place. And about 5 minutes later, and I wish I was exaggerating, about 5 minutes later, everybody has done the procedure and they're back onto the rug. And so one of the recommendations that day was, hey, you have a pretty good procedure in place. We just really need to tighten this up. And as kindergartners, we got to get that down to, let's say, 90 seconds or less. And 2 weeks later, I saw the same procedure, and she had gotten it down to 1 minute. So we're talking about 20, 25 kindergartners in less than 60 seconds. They could literally walk across the room, open the drawers, put their stuff away, drawers back to the rug. I was so impressed. And I bragged on her quite a bit with her principal.
Very cool. Very cool. So earlier we were talking about a podcast that you had watched around this. So speak to us about that podcast and how it influenced your thinking around standard versus expectation.
Absolutely. So here recently I've been introduced to Ed Milet, and not personally, I would love to meet him, but his podcast. And so this was a podcast with Ed Milet and Inky Johnson, and Inky was talking about standard versus expectation. And it resonated with me so powerfully with teachers and administrators. And so Inky says, first of all, what the difference is. The difference, the standard is internal. So anything you tell yourself and you hold yourself to, that's a standard. Some people might even call that discipline or self-discipline. So this morning I got up at 5 a.m. to go work out. Well, why did I do that? Because I had a conversation with myself last night. I was going to get up at 5 and go work out. And so at 5 o'clock, the alarm clock goes off and I'm like, and I get up and I go work out. That's it. Because there's a standard there, Kevin, that I want to hold myself to. I want to work out every day. And in fact, at this point in my life, I get really upset when I don't go work out. So there's a standard there. So when in the classroom, when we teach a procedure, for example, we want to hold students to a standard. Now, the standard is on the teacher side. That's on the internal side. The expectation is on the external side. There's an expectation there that when I tell students how to enter the room, for example, there's an expectation that students are going to do it the exact way I have taught them to do it, and they're going to do it 100% perfection and 100% participation. And then the standard kicks in when that doesn't happen. And then I start mitigating. I start saying, okay, nope, it wasn't 100% correct. We're going to go back and practice that procedure. When you don't meet my expectation, that's when I see where the standard kicks in. This occurs with my children. This occurs in a lot of facets of my life. I'm thinking about administrators when they, in fact, I'm thinking of one particular administrator, recent story, where a particular group of her teachers, a particular grade level, just were poor communicators. They weren't using the app that they had declared that they would use to keep parents informed. And when parents used that app, they wouldn't get replies. And so the teachers were essentially ignoring the app that they declared they were going to use. And so the principal's comment to me was, well, I've told them over and over and over again. Okay, that may be true, but obviously the message isn't being communicated well or not resilient enough. And so to me, that's where we're not holding people accountable to an expectation and the standard is not kicked in. So that's just, you know, another example there. But administrators, when you declare something or you tell your teachers to do something, please follow through. Because if you don't, you lose all credibility. Just like teachers do, that teachers lose credibility when they say, Billy, you're going to lose 10 minutes recess today. And then Billy doesn't lose 10 minutes at recess. You know, your words are now empty. And so you lose credibility. You lose, students don't respect you. And, you know, obviously problems occur when that happens.
Yeah, that's powerful. So let's speak about this now in regards to your work with safety. So you do a lot of work around safety, safety audits for schools and districts. So what is it? What's your main focus of that work that you do?
So the main focus is the safety audit, the big 3-year audits that are required by TEA, for every district and charter, you have to do the big audit once every 3 years. And Texas School Safety Center maintains a 3-year cycle, and districts and charters are on 2 different 3-year cycles. So it's kind of, you got to kind of keep up with that, but it's the same audit for districts and charters. So it's just basically literally going through that checklist and walking campuses and looking for a number of concerns that might show up. And then I take a lot of photos and give feedback to campuses and district leaders on, you know, these are some concerns. These are some good things. These are some things that you might want to fix right away. These are some things that you probably could fix, you know, in 30 days or 60 days, or maybe this summer. But sometimes we find things that need to be fixed right this second.
Yes. It seems like another instance of forest through the trees, because these folks are in these schools, in these districts, day after day after day. It could be such that there are certain things there, certain violations that they've just kind of become blind to. They just don't see it. Is that something that you discover in your work?
Yes, absolutely. And because they're in that environment day to day, they just don't see things from a warning or what I call red flag vantage point. And something that I commonly see on campuses are large rocks or bricks, and they're just kind of laying around campus. And I know that sounds strange, but I mean, think about all the concrete that we use in our campuses, and you know, it's quite common to see, you know, little chunks of concrete up, or we're using rocks as ornaments, or we're using rocks as, kind of to cover our flower beds, that kind of stuff. But yeah, those are red flags, because if the rock is large enough, it could be picked up, it could be thrown, it could hurt a student. You could throw one through a window and smash a window pretty easily. So that's a common thing I see on campuses that. You know, when you mention that, nobody's really thinking about those rocks. They see them on the ground every day. They walk by them 100 times, and it's just not a big deal to them in their mind.
Generally, Dr. Q, what's the response when you bring these red flags to people's attention? Are they, oh, thank you, so glad you brought that to our attention? Or what kind of reaction do you get?
Well, it kind of depends on what it is. I mean, when you mention the rocks, it's like sometimes you'll get a okay. But when I, for example, on one campus that I went to, I started walking, looking for a way to get in unauthorized, a way to get in unauthorized. And so I happened to go to a door, and the student pushed the door open for me. I didn't even have to knock on the door. I didn't have to talk to the student. Student was very kind, unfortunately, to open the door and let me walk in. I graciously thanked the student as I walked by her and just kind of walked the campus for 10 minutes until I was discovered by a teacher. And so that's a huge red flag, obviously. And we want to teach our students not to open doors for strangers or for anyone for that matter. If I want to get into the building, or let me rephrase, if I need to get into the building, I will need to go through the front door. Please teach your students that. But so when that was mentioned, yes, there was some concern, some panic. They couldn't believe it. And, you know, so they put some things in place right away.
I see some common denominators in your work. So it sounds like, Dr. Q, your work is largely about building those routines, those procedures, so that the good work can happen, the learning can happen. Also, making sure that there's a safe environment so that you don't have to worry about these other external factors and you can, again, focus on the learning. And that when you do all these things, actually, the teaching and learning can be more enjoyable. It can be more fun. It can be more interesting. So some of the things that you're talking about aren't always the shiny, fun things to get to do, but they're critically important things to do. So is there anything else education-wise, since this podcast is called Just Thinking, about which you are just thinking, that I didn't give you a chance to speak to? So you get the last word, Dr. Q.
All right. Well, just kind of piggyback off of what you just said. You know, you're familiar with fight or flight or freeze, right? When you feel unsafe, you're going to be in that fright or flight mental state. And here's what we know. That's an emotional state. That's not a learning state. So when it goes to safety, if our classrooms are not physically safe or emotionally safe, because sometimes we don't really even think about that piece of it, but we really need our classrooms to be an emotionally safe place there. And why is that so important? Because so I can get out of that fight or flight mental space and I can actually get into a cognitive learning place. And so, you know, just kind of as we're kind of wrapping this up, that's just kind of what I was thinking.
Shrink that amygdala. I love it. Well, I appreciate you for being on this podcast, and I look forward to future conversations with you, Dr. Q.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.